We now turn to item number 2.3 on your list, the Hippocratic Oath. And we'll be considering, of course, the Hippocratic Oath from the perspective of Christianity. Now, the question should naturally arise, why are we considering the Hippocratic Oath here and not earlier with the other material which was reflective of the Hippocratic tradition and the Greece medical tradition from centuries before the birth of Christ? And the answer is that the Hippocratic Oath as a document existed. And as we'll see, it describes a very high moral code. But the simple reality is that the majority of practicing physicians throughout the Greco-Roman tradition did not follow the Hippocratic Oath literally. And it seems unlikely that they even swore it. The idea of swearing the Hippocratic Oath on the completion of your medical training, which has, of course, been a tradition within Christianity, for many centuries, does not seem to have been paralleled by any such tradition in classical antiquity. Now, the Hippocratic Oath was known. It was revered as a document, revered as a tradition, but of a very high moral standard, which in some ways people did not expect to be lived out in the ordinary context, setting perhaps a kind of a high role, a high model, but not necessarily something that had to be taken as a law or as binding. We know this, obviously, from the medical texts that we've already looked at, the writings of Cyranus, who refers himself to some of the Hippocratic texts that, as we'll see, are in direct violation to contradiction of some of the tenets of the oath, particularly the portion of the oath that forbids abortion. Well, as I believe I mentioned in an earlier lecture, the Hippocratic Oath as a binding document, as something that would really describe what physicians were expected to be, is a phenomenon of the Christianized Roman Empire. It may have been used by a small sect of physicians. There are some medical historians who speculate that this may have been a sect of Pythagoreans who had ethical norms that are very compatible with those that we see in the oath. But this is uncertain, and there's no documentary evidence for the existence of such a sect, such a small group of specially trained and specifically committed physicians. But it becomes very widespread. It's referred to and is clearly used within the context of Christianity because from the 4th century onward, we find Christianized forms of the oath, sometimes sworn in its original form, invoking in a kind of a symbolic form the deities of ancient Greece, the healing gods and goddesses of ancient Greece, and sometimes very specifically, as we'll see, modified to make it into a Christian document, speaking instead of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So the Hippocratic Oath as a medical binding oath, as something that really defined patterns of behavior for physicians as a practical guide, is, strangely enough, a phenomenon of Christianized medicine. And let's look at the oath itself, at the text of it. It begins with an invocation of these deities, Apollo, Asclepius, Hygeia and Panacea, Hygeia and Panacea being lesser deities, Apollo the principal patron of physicians, Asclepius, a lesser deity, the offspring of Apollo, and also divine, often depicted holding the caduceus, the staff with the serpent, which was the physician's symbol. I might add parenthetically, when I swore the Hippocratic Oath myself on my graduation from medical school, we used a modified form of the Hippocratic Oath, which is generally the pattern that is done in most medical schools which use the Hippocratic Oath and not some other binding text. The version we had included, rather intriguingly, these specific deities, but it had eliminated the prohibition against abortion. So it seems odd that in the modern world, one would be expected to invoke deities in whom no one believes, but nevertheless, one would feel perfectly free to delete the ethical norms that would allow this to be a document that reflected a high standard of medical practice continuously used for more than 1,500, 600 years. Well, anyway, an invocation of these deities and the oath being sworn to them meant that they were the guardians of one's promise and understand that they would become enraged or turn against one if one violated it. So the next section that I've labeled the indenture is the commitment to the teachers of medicine. And this oath particularly created a relationship of new family between the newly trained physician and the person who had trained him or her. To regard the one who taught me this art as dear as my own parents, to share my substance with them to relieve their necessities, to look on their offsprings as my own brothers, and to teach them this art if they wish to learn it without fee. So a willingness to teach medicine to the children of physicians without requiring them to pay. So this is the creation also of a medical guild, of a kind of a society which is self-perpetuating and committed to its members and to the children of its members. Then a description of the method by which this is done. By precept, by lecture, that is to say by one-to-one discussion, by lecture where you're interacting with multiple people, and every other mode of instruction, I'll impart a knowledge of the art to my own sons and those of my teachers, and to disciples bound by the stipulation and oath according to the law of medicine, but to none others. So again, this is a document that was intended probably within this small sect or group that actually used it in classical antiquity, about which we really don't know anything, and it became a rather closed society. And then if we move down to the section that I've labeled number 3, favor life, I'll follow the regimen which, according to my ability and judgment, is for the benefit of my patients, abstain from whatever is deleterious and mischievous. I will give no deadly medicine, pharmakon, to anyone if asked, nor suggest any such counsel. So there here is the absolute prohibition against assisting in suicide. Physicians are not permitted to give a deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor to suggest this. And this is an issue that does crop up in ancient medical texts. What do you do to someone who is suffering agonizing pain? Can you give them a medication that will end their life? And in general, the medical texts of antiquity are very reticent, very unwilling to describe drugs or methods that can be used to do this. Now, in fact, it was done, probably done in a fairly widespread way, given the fact that a very large percentage of physicians in ancient Rome and in ancient Greece were slaves or freedmen, people who had just recently been slaves and were still attached to the families of which they had formerly been slaves and owed them money. Now, if your master, as we'll see, wanted to commit suicide, you would be expected to provide a very swift and painless way of doing that. So this group, this document, is opposed to that, and the reason that it's in here, obviously, is that it was done. And we know that there are other cultures where it was routinely done. In the ancient Near East, where you had a tradition of a divinized or of a divine ruler, particularly in Egypt, it seems to have been not uncommon that the death of a pharaoh would be effected very often through palace intrigue or through the person who's going to inherit, by the pharaoh's physician, because you couldn't have people publicly killing a divine being. It had to happen mysteriously. It had to happen quietly. So that's part of the reason why you have to have this prohibition. You don't include a prohibition unless a practice is pretty widespread. So here is a model of medicine that does not counsel euthanasia and does not assist in euthanasia. And the next phrase, in like manner, similarly, I will not give to a woman a pessary, that is to say, something that is inserted into the birth canal, into the vagina, and therefore next to the opening to the uterus, in order to produce abortion. So I will not use a device. And the implication is, or a drug that would cause an abortion. So there is, in the same phrase, a rejection both of euthanasia, of assisted suicide, and of any participation in abortion. And a kind of a summary, with purity and holiness, I will pass my life and practice my art. It goes on, and this is something that causes many scholars to scratch their heads, because at this point, states that the practitioner will not practice surgery, or at least not practice the very brutal and mutilating form of surgery that was used to remove bladder stones from those who suffered from them. I will not cut persons laboring under the stone, but will leave this to be done by men who are practitioners of this work. So there seems to be here a reticence to engage in at least certain kinds of surgery, and to have another class of individuals who are surgeons and not necessarily physicians, not iatroi. This will become fairly standard in the West in the Middle Ages, and then into a relatively modern time, certainly into the 18th and into the 19th centuries, where a surgeon and a physician are not necessarily the same. A surgeon is one who practices surgery, who cuts, who knows anatomy, and engages in the practice of performing operations, and a physician is one who principally prescribes medication and other remedies, might be involved in setting bones, but does not actually cut through skin. So in a sense, the distinction today between a surgeon and an internist would correspond to the ancient distinction between a surgeon and a physician. So there's a, at least for the practitioners of this art, those who are swearing this oath, there is a statement that I will not perform, certainly not that particular surgical procedure. Then it goes on to say that I will not abuse my office into whatever house I enter. I will go for the benefit of the sick and abstain from every volunteer act of mischief and corruption. And specifically, I will not sexually abuse patients. I will abstain from the seduction of females or males, of freedmen and of slaves. This is a terrible reminder to us also of the fact that slavery in the Roman Empire, and this would have been true in ancient Greece as well, very often, if not in the majority of cases, involved slaves in an expectation that they would allow themselves to be used sexually by their masters. It's a tragic phenomenon, a tragic reality, that very often marriage was not the place in Greco-Roman society where one sought a real sexual satisfaction or joy. Marriages were arranged, and one's slaves were often available for that and expected to be available. So to be a slave meant very often to be in a state where sexual abuse was expected, was permitted. Now, this is being rejected within the context of the professional relationship that constitutes medicine. But it's a reminder of how tragic the state of life was for people who lived in slavery, particularly in the ancient Roman Empire. We don't know what proportion of society this was, but it may well have been upward of 50 to 60% or more of society were in this state. There's a section on confidentiality, number 6. Whatever in connection with professional practice or not connected with it I see or hear in the life of men which ought not be spoken of abroad, I will not divulge this. I will not speak about these things. In other words, I will keep confidence, reckoning that all such should be kept secret. So there's a commitment to professional confidentiality, to not sharing what one learns in the course of medical practice. This would mean that medicine itself, to some extent, would be regarded as the practice of medicine might be kept secret in some ways, but in a particular way, it specifically meant that that what one learned about patients could not be shared with anybody other than those patients. And then number 7, the oath, while I continue to keep this oath unviolated, may it be granted to me to enjoy life, but should I trespass it, may the reverse be my lot. The usual re-invocation at the end of an oath, in which one says, and if I'm telling the truth, may I be rewarded, and if I'm lying, I should be cursed. Now, in number 2.4, what I've provided here is the Christianized, or one of the later Christianized forms of the Hippocratic Oath. And there are, as I said, variants in Greek that date from the earliest Christianized Roman Empire, particularly from the 4th century onwards. But here I've taken a translation of a Latin version quite late in the Middle Ages, from the 14th century, It was very widely used in Europe, and it's a reminder that the oath continued to be used even after the profession of medicine had been secularized, as it was during the Middle Ages when the church began to be reticent to allow the clergy the regular practice of medicine, and this particular form of the Hippocratic Oath seems to have been rather widely used. If we'll look at it, it contains most of the provisions we've seen, but the beginning is an invocation of the Christian God. Blessed be God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who is blessed forever and ever. I do not lie. I'm telling the truth. I will bring no stain on the learning of the medical art. And then specifically, the ethical norms that we've already highlighted. I will neither give poison to anyone, though asked to do so, nor will I suggest such a plan. So taken directly from the traditional or ancient form of the oath, I will not engage in euthanasia, nor will I assist in euthanasia or suggest it as an option to people. Nor will I give treatment to women to cause abortion. And here it's even more specific, treatment neither from above nor from below. Remember that in the Hippocratic Oath, there was the mention of this pessary, a device or a medication that would have been placed within the woman's body. Well, here the physician also says, I will not give anything that would cause an abortion from above. That is to say, a drug that a woman would take, which would cause her body such violence that an abortion might result. And as we'll see, people knew in classical antiquity that this was very dangerous and often involved a danger of death to the woman. And then this Christianized version of the oath goes on, I will teach this art to those who require to learn it without an indenture, that is to say, without requiring them to commit themselves to me effectively as professional slaves for a period of time, so I'll do it freely. I will use treatment to help the sick according to my ability and judgment in purity and holiness. I will guard my art. And here, too, also a specific statement that, and it's understandable given that physicians have access to people in a very intimate sort of way. They would see them naked. They would examine them. There's a specific condemnation of any sexual misbehavior. Into whatever houses I enter, I'll do so to help the sick, keeping myself free from all wrongdoing, intentional or unintentional, tending to death or to injury, and from fornication with bond or free, that is to say, with a slave or a serf, whether they're male or female. And whatever I see or hear in the course of my practice that ought not to be published abroad, that I will not divulge. I will consider such things to be holy secrets. So the principal statements that we found in the ancient form of the Hippocratic Oath are reiterated here in the Christianized version. A rejection of abortion or of euthanasia or of assisted suicide, a willingness to teach the medical art, a specific condemnation of any sexual abuse of patients, and the notion of confidentiality, that one does not share what one learns about the sick with anybody other than those who are taking care of the sick. And at the end of it, the same kind of reiteration of the oath, a reprofession of one's sincerity that one saw in the ancient version. Now, if we shift down and back to the early church, in section 2.5, this red bar with an image of a little child off to the side, we'll see we're going to look at a reference to or a statement by the theologian Tertullian, who writes at the end of the second or beginning of the third century. And he mentions what we have already seen in the writings of the pagan physician Soranus, and which was made specific reference to, or the ethical issue that was raised in the context of the Talmud, and that is the medical practice of destroying a child that cannot be delivered. What is the physician to do if it's impossible to deliver the child, and any medical procedure, any surgical procedure you would try to perform will have the effect either of killing the mother in the case of a cesarean section, or of killing the child if you try to drag the child out of the birth canal. So Tertullian, unlike the Talmud, does not say that Christians are permitted to allow craniotomy or embryotomy, this destruction of and literally incising of the child about to be born. But in a sense, he depicts the terrible ethical situation and laments it, but doesn't say that Christians are either forbidden to acquiesce to it or that they are permitted to accept it. He is simply speaking about this terrible ethical problem. And then in the text that I've given you, which you've already read and you're reading, of course, from David Albert Jones, The Soul of the Embryo, Jones points out that it would be difficult for theologians to address this question, and in fact, for the first 1,000 years of the Church's history, theologians clearly don't want to talk about this terrible dilemma. They leave it open, they leave it in silence, and instead, when they speak about abortion, they speak about abortion in contexts that are much clearer, where the moral issues are more specific. Now, the principle that will be elaborated or will generally be accepted will be that a Christian may not choose the life of one over the other. That is, if the infant is about to be born alive but can't be delivered, one cannot either kill the child to save the mother or sacrifice the mother in order to save the child. One must do everything medically possible to try to save both. This is in general what will evolve when the Church begins to formally and clearly wrestle with this issue much later in the tradition. And there will be voices that are raised to challenge this. There will be theologians as late as the 19th century who will argue that it may be permissible to perform this terrible operation of craniotomy, that is literally to kill the child in order to save the life of the mother, arguing that the child is an unjust aggressor or that it's the lesser of the evils to be chosen. Now, we can rejoice in the fact that this almost never occurs in the modern world, but issues analogous to or related to it, where people are convinced, perhaps wrongly in many cases, that that's the issue that they are struggling with, even in our own day, will find themselves agonizing over this kind of choice. And as we'll see when we look at the question of abortion, then making decisions that are sometimes not compatible with church tradition. So Tertullian laments this circumstance, but he does not provide a clear moral guideline as to what Christians are to do. But there is nothing within the Christian literature that would be the equivalent of the Talmud at this point that suggests that Christians are permitted to allow embryotomy or craniotomy. Tertullian just talks about it as a terrible thing. So if you drop down to the section on the soul, Tertullian on the Soul, section 25 of that work. For how could one die who had not previously been alive? His whole point in this document, in this text on the soul, is to try to wrestle with the question of where does the soul come from? Is it spontaneously created for each new human being by God, or is it somehow passed down from the parents in a strange metaphysical way through the parents' souls, or maybe even through their bodies? And in asking this question, he has to say, do we believe that the child who is just an embryo or then a fetus or is about to be born, do we believe that that child has a soul? Do we believe that that child is truly alive and truly human? And his answer is absolutely yes. We do believe that the child is alive, that the child is human. But, he says, sometimes by a cruel necessity, necessaria crudelitate, while still in the womb, an infant is put to death, is killed. And then he describes because it's lying sidewise and making delivery impossible, and would kill the mother unless the child died. And then he goes on to describe the terrible procedure of craniotomy and embryotomy. And finally, if we drop down towards the end of this section, he mentions that such devices or practices are mentioned, as we've seen, by Hippocrates and particularly by Soranus. And Soranus, he mentions, pitied this unfortunate sort of infant, which had to be killed before birth so that it would not be alive as it was torn to pieces. So Soranus destroys the head of the child, not just as a part of the procedure, but in order to kill the child quickly and, as he thought, mercifully, in order that the child would not experience the pain of being torn to pieces as it was being delivered. So he then says in the conclusion of this section, of the necessity, de qua necessitate scleres, of such hard treatment, of such unnecessary and harsh treatment, I have no doubt even Hechesius was convinced, another author that he's quoting and referring to. So Tertullian is looking with fear and trembling and horror at this ethical circumstance, and he's not trying to proclaim that Christians may or may not permit this, but that this is a terrible reality, and in all of this, nevertheless, it reminds us that we do regard the child about to be born as fully human and as possessing a soul. And as we'll see, again, detailed discussions of this particular aspect of the problem of abortion, of obstetrical infanticide, will really not be discussed formally or in detail in the Christian tradition until the Middle Ages.